Well, guys, today we are joined by a guest, so I wanted to make sure that the cold open was, a really light and breezy topic.
Oh
So
no.
just really quick,
Have you guys ever died at a funeral?
what do you guys want your funeral to be like?
Oh.
What a fun question. You're right. I want a lot of snacks. That's like all I care
Oh
about.
yeah,
It's just
that's
food,
nice.
which is kind of sad because I won't be able to eat it, I guess. But I
Bury
would
me
like
with them.
Bury me with
Bury
snacks.
me with my Doritos.
You know how, like, at some funerals, everyone gets to toss a handful of dirt in? Paige is like, pick your favorite snack off
Oh
the table,
yeah.
and everyone tosses in one snack.
Get some Cheez-Its here, some jelly beans there. It's perfect. I love this idea.
It's great when you get reanimated as a zombie. Yeah, a nice little like wake up snack. And then you can start
Zombies.
eating brains.
Zombies traditionally eat Cheez-Its and
Yeah.
jelly beans and then progress from there. That makes sense.
Well, it's like the last remnants of your human brain. You're like, "Oh, I see food. I must eat it. Oh, this is gross." Human brain time. That's how it goes.
Paige is actually a practicing Egyptian, so
Oh,
whatever she gets buried with, she gets in the afterlife. So
Yes.
only snacks is what she wants.
Hey, I
Yes.
mean, that'll get you down the Nile pretty far, right?
What?
I mean, Vikings got some pretty fun funeral
Yeah.
whatever rituals. You get put on a boat and then the boat gets lit on fire. That's fun.
Is that your choice?
No, because
Oh,
I'm not a
okay.
Viking, but it's a good one. It would
Okay.
kind of feel like I would be like a Viking weeb if I did that. Like,
It's a
I'm not
little
a
bit of
Viking.
cultural appropriation.
Yeah.
Well, I've always maintained that I want my casket to be carried into the song Thunderstruck by AC/DC.
Okay.
Separate from anything else, just that's the only demand 100% set in stone.
Is it just like someone throws it up on like their like Spotify playlist, or do you want like a live like orchestral thing to
Oh. Yeah.
I've always thought of it as like played from the speakers, but I don't know where we would be that there would be naturally speakers in the venue.
The
You
Boise
know?
State Stadium.
Taco Bell Arena or
Yeah.
whatever.
Get buried underneath the Smurf turf.
Yeah, just bury me right under the blue turf. So that way, and BSU can help lower me in. That way they can let me down one last time.
XD. Oh my God. What a
Oh.
zing!
Yeah, besides, I don't know, because, a little peek behind the curtain. But a couple of weeks ago, we took a break from this podcast so that I could be with my grandfather as he passed away. And last week, we went to his funeral, and it was very nice. It was a very small, private family affair. And the whole time,
Any
my fam,
Thunderstruck?
no
Oh,
thunderstruck, no,
Thunderstruck.
no. But my family was like, "Well, the funeral's not really for him; it's for us." And I was like, "That's some horseshit. Like, when I die, I want everyone to listen to me one last time. That's all I'm looking for." So I don't know.
But all you've got is Thunderstruck. That's really not a lot for us to go off of.
That's true. I could
Yeah.
make it a little more extreme. I also watched all the Mission Impossible movies last week, which is these are two completely different things that happened. So maybe like the casket bearers can do like a halo drop with my casket
Oh,
and then
that's a terrible
two
idea.
thunderstruck and then they land and then put me in the ground.
No, they don't land. Or like they're carrying it.
They don't land, they just die.
Yeah, they just float off into the atmosphere as
It's a
all
seven-man
skydivers do.
funeral.
No, what I'm assuming is like they just like line it up perfectly and then they just like drop your casket and like hopefully there isn't a lot of wind and just slams into like the ground and then that's where you're buried.
That sounds great to me, honestly. I can't, no notes. Perfect.
And you better have like those like little smoke trails coming off of your casket, like on each corner. Maybe they put a little spin so you get like a nice cool helix design going down.
Okay.
I know so many people are like, I want my funeral to be like a party. I don't want anyone to be sad and be a celebration. I'm like, no. I want everyone to be devastated.
Everyone's wearing black. And no one is going to have fun.
This is my time to shine. And like, I need everyone to be very sad that I'm gone.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's a slightly different tone than Thunderstruck, I guess.
Yeah.
It's like a little different.
Oh, I know. You like commission Sarah McLachlan or whatever her name is. I don't know.
Yes, yeah.
And all the sad things.
Like, yeah, and you just like show pictures of you. That's going to get everyone just so depressed.
Yeah, I want them to not be able to go on without me.
Just bury me with her. That's all I want.
Yeah.
I can't go on without
people
her.
Throwing themselves down, down onto the casket.
That's the sign of a good funeral. That's it right there.
What do you guys say we talk about this movie?
Yeah, sure.
Let's do it.
All right.
This is
Discovering Directors.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Discovering Directors, a podcast where we talk about a director's entire filmography, one movie at a time, one week at a time, to paint a picture of their entire career, their influences, and their motivations. My name is Ethan Tyler Paula Chaffee Cooper.
My name is Paige Mazath Mary Cooper.
I'm Sydney.
And today we are joined by a guest. Today we have with us Ellen Beck from We Should Watch a Movie and Love That Movie podcast, two different podcasts.
Wow!
And she still made time to join us on this show. Ellen, welcome. Say hello to the people.
Hello. Thanks for having me. Yeah, technically two different podcasts, although one of them I record kind of by myself, and then I just have guests on, so naturally I procrastinate like hell, and we'll say I'm on a hiatus, because it's been like a month or two since I put out an episode. Well over.
A self-imposed hiatus every now and then, I think, is worthy.
Absolutely. Yes,
I do record We Should Watch a Movie with friends Danny and Ty. They're also part of the Mad About Movies family, and we're just three dumb idiots that love to talk about movies and, I don't know, make fun of each other for having not seen certain movies. That's like the whole premise started with. We would always make fun of our friend Danny because he hasn't seen a lot of movies, even though he likes to talk about them. So we would make him watch stuff that were like, you have to see this. I love this movie. And kind of went from there. So each week we pick a movie that one of us hasn't seen and we talk about it. And yeah, it's just a lot of us making fun of each other.
I feel like Danny and I would get along really well.
Yeah.
Man, that sounds a lot like how this podcast got started, because Ethan and Paige were like, Wes Anderson, he's pretty good. I'm like, I got no idea who he is. And they're like, okay, you're going to watch these.
We're going to fix Danny.
I'm telling you, this episode one, we had Danny watch a Wes Anderson movie because he had really not seen any of his movies before. And we're like,
which one?
He got Fantastic Mr. Fox, because that's my favorite. And it was my choice.
Nice.
It's a good one.
Yeah. A worthy choice.
We're big fans.
Yeah, I listened to y'all talk about Fantastic Mr. Fox. I was like, that's my favorite movie.
I feel like not one of our best episodes, but, you know.
That's because we were a disaster that night. I'm pretty sure we were just saying random shit that came into our brains instead of following any type of a path. So it was perfect.
Okay.
Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Good I love movie.
That. I love a good tangent, and I love, breaking whatever kind of format we're trying to do. I often derail whatever, because Danny really likes to follow format, and I'm like, no.
That's what we have guests on for, is to break the format, so you're going to fit right in around here. But speaking of the format, though, today we are talking about a Frank Oz movie. This is our fourth season, our season on Frank Oz, and today is our last Frank Oz episode.
What? Aww. I thought we were only halfway done.
You know, it still feels like that somehow, because this season has been eternal, more on the back end than on the front end. Mm-hmm. But we are here now at the end of Frank Oz's theatrical productions. We may still do a little bit in our wrap-up episode about In and of Itself, which came out on Hulu this year.
So good.
That's all I've ever heard about it. So, you know, it's probably worth our time to talk at least a little bit about that. But this is the last of our theatrical films, and here we are. Should we just jump into it?
Hell yeah.
Let's jump.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the background to Frank Oz getting into this movie. Ellen, what are your opinions on Frank Oz or your experiences with him as a director, as a, you know, Muppet guy, whatever frame you have on him? What's your experience like?
Yeah, so I didn't know him too much as like a director. Very much knew him as the Muppet guy. He's Yoda too, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was like, I always knew him as Yoda and like the Muppet guy forever, and then like didn't really know that he was much of a director. Kind of went back and like looked at his, you know, what movies he's directed, and I really haven't seen that many of them, and they kind of seem to be all over the place.
That is correct. Yep.
That's what we've learned. Yes.
Yeah.
And it's random movies that I've seen and ones that like, you know, I love musicals, but I've never actually sat down and watched Little Shop of Horrors, even though it's like always been on my list, which is crazy. One would say that this is probably the best movie on his list, even though I don't know too much.
Some people would say that. We're contractually obligated not to say that yet because we haven't done our wrap-up episode, but...
But yes.
But yes.
Yeah. Muppets Take Manhattan is kind of funny that it is
a movie.
It is not like other Muppet movies, and now I know why, because it's the one that Frank Oz did. But yeah, it is a bummer to see a list of movies and be like, the one that I know I saw was Indian in the Cupboard.
Oh,
yes.
Because <Yeah. laughs> I was a kid in the 90s, and I know that saw that movie.
That is a little unfortunate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can't really speak much to him as, oh, God, no.
You don't deserve that hair.
That's for the better that you don't remember it, honestly.
I was really going to say, lucky you.
Yeah, so, and then I think I saw Stepford Wives at one point. But so, like, all of these just feel really, like, there's no string that ties them together. And, you know, some directors, I guess, are just like that.
Yeah. I think what we've kind of stumbled on, and I have a big overarching theme that I'll probably share towards the end of this episode, but one of the things we've kind of stumbled on is that he's not really the artist necessarily of any of these movies, but he is really good at executing whoever the artist is vision. And so he's good at pulling, you know, what they were trying to do with their script and then bringing that to the screen and getting it made, you know, making money. I mean, the guy has an insane career of movies where each one makes enough money to keep him going, which cannot be said for pretty much, you know, the vast majority of directors in Hollywood, I feel like, fail out fairly early before they hit 12 movies, certainly. So, yeah. So to talk a little bit about his experience getting to the making of this movie, we have to go back just a little bit to our Muppet days. So around the time that Stepford Wives released in theaters, the Walt Disney Company purchased the rights to the characters, the Muppets. And Dick Cook, who was the chairman of Disney at the time, basically looked through all of the projects that the Muppet guys hadn't finished. So anything that Jim Henson had written on that never actually made it to a movie, and tried to pick something out of that to put on screen to reintroduce the Muppets to a new generation. And one of the ones that he found that he really liked was a script called The Cheapest Muppet Movie Ever Made. And that was originally written by Jim Henson, Frank Oz, and Jerry Jewell, who, you know, we've talked about all these guys, but Jerry Jewell is the typical Muppets writer. And the three of them kind of came together and came up with the idea of, what if there was a movie that was all about the Muppets immediately blowing their budget on like the title sequence. And then the rest of the movie was them having to do everything like as cheaply as possible. And so that was the project that Jim Henson was working on when he passed away in 1990. So it was like right before the Muppets pivoted to doing some of the more like storybook movies. This was the one that they were working on getting done when Jim Henson passed away. And so the project was kind of put on the shelf. And like I said, the next theatrical release was Treasure Island, I believe. So Dick Cook took this script and he reached out to Frank Oz and he was like, hey, I need something that's going to get people back in theaters. Like, I think people will come out for a Frank Oz Muppet movie. And so we need you to come back on board. And also, like, I think you are the only one who's going to be good enough to kind of make this accessible to a new generation.
I thought you were going to say, and you're the only Muppets director that's still alive. Because that would feel weird.
It would feel weird. Thankfully, I mean, Brian Henson, Jim Henson's son, directed the two storybook Muppet movies, Treasure Island and Christmas Carol. Yeah. So he's still around, but
Christmas Carol's my all-time favorite Muppet movie and Christmas movie.
Yes, those are my top two.
For the record.
Yeah, Muppet movie number one, Christmas Carol two for me, which is weird because I normally despise everything Christmas.
It's true.
But it's so good.
It's so funny. Gosh, I love that movie.
But when it came about to actually start working on the project, they couldn't agree on a budget. So Dick Cook kind of took the title very literally and was like, oh, this is actually going to be the cheapest Muppet movie ever made. Like, you're only going to need $8 or $9 million, you know, in 2006 to make this movie. And Frank Oz kind of fought back and was like, no, to do the script right, like, I need a lot of heavy special effects. Like, the whole bit essentially is that Gonzo gets a chance to direct a Muppet movie. And so he, like, makes volcanoes explode. He has a bunch of fireworks. They, like, demolish a building, like, all in the opening sequence. And Frank Oz is like, all of that costs money. And then for the rest of the movie, when they're, like, trying to cut costs, quote unquote, they're doing a lot of jokes that are actually about it, like, not cutting costs. So, again, they're, like, demolishing more buildings. There's even a joke where, like, Meryl Streep was supposed to step in for Miss Piggy for a scene. Because the joke was supposed to be like, oh, Meryl is less of a pay than Miss Piggy is. And so Frank Oz was like, no, we have to keep to the script. We have to keep all of that. And so the two of them were kind of clashing. And then Bob Iger came in as the head of Disney. And he did not like the Muppets very much. And so he was kind of iffy on the idea of Frank Oz continuing to do this project. And that's when Jason Segel came in and pitched the Muppets, which is the movie that they eventually went through, like, the full Muppet reboot, because of, like, that was going to cost less money and also just as, like, a fresh way to start for new fans. And so after losing that job, Frank Oz kind of took a step back. And even before Stepford Wives, he had been saying in interviews that he wanted to make just a small, small budget comedy. Like, he was like, the big budgets, they go to my head. Like, I try to please the studio too much. That's what happened with Stepford Wives. Like, I just want a very, very small budget to go in and just make a movie that I think people are going to like. And so finally the opportunity came along to make this movie for what I believe was only $9 million he was given to make this movie with a bunch of, you know, rising British comedians. And he says that he doesn't see it as like a British comedy because he's like, oh, I was just making a comedy. Like, it's not necessarily British toned or anything like that. But we'll talk about that when we get into the plot.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, but the humor is very, very British.
Yes.
And in addition to that, I watched, because I have a stupid completionist brain, the 2010 American remake of Death at a Funeral, and that one tries its damnedest to make it you know, like American humor, and doesn't quite work as well. So we'll probably talk about that a little bit. But this movie released August 17th, 2007 in the United States on kind of a limited release because it did a lot of the festival circuits and went to a lot of the smaller festivals, nothing too huge, no Cannes or South By or Sundance or anything like that. But it did a lot of the minor festivals and then finally released in the U.S. Let's talk about this movie. I think okay. we should do... Let's do initial reactions first. And normally I would make Paige go first because that's what my brain says. But why don't we let our guests go first? Ellen, if you just want to give us kind of your basic first glance thoughts of Death at a Funeral.
I saw this for the first time just a couple years ago. I absolutely loved this movie. Background on me, I'm an absolute, like, I'm obsessed with all things British. I love British humor. I love British history. A girl living in Texas that should have been born in, like, the English countryside for sure.
You obviously prefer tea over coffee, right?
Not necessarily. I mean, I prefer Earl Grey tea over any other tea, but okay. But I do drink a ton of coffee just as like a caffeine addict. I almost was going to drink an Earl Grey tea right now, but ooh. I decided I didn't feel like boiling water. But no, I absolutely love this movie. It's hilarious start to finish for me.
I'll agree with you right there. And, you know, part of it might just be that we've been, like I've said, I feel like the past couple of weeks, but we've been in the Frank Oz minds for so long that some of his tendencies, some of his stars, you know, some of the jokes that he's kind of used to were starting to wear on me a little bit. But I'm a really tough sell for a straight comedy. They don't always work for me. And I freaking love this movie. I think it is so funny from start to finish. And yeah, I enjoy every single character. I think every single, you know, actor and actress is giving it their all. I think it's really hilarious. And it bums me out now that this is his last movie because I'm like, no, keep making these. Like, this is, you know, what I wanted from you all this time. I'm a really big fan.
Do you think the fact that he like came up with the Muppets, which is an ensemble comedy troupe, led to him making such a like kind of perfect ensemble comedy movie with just, you know, not Muppets, real people?
I think it definitely helps. I mean, I've said it before, I think on the Bowfinger episode, but Frank Oz's comedies, I think, feel the best to me when they are more structured like a Muppet show or like a Muppet movie. Like when the characters are getting to do more than, and this one has a lot of like sitting or standing around and talking, but all the characters are so heightened that it still has that Muppet energy. But like, you know, Alan Tudyk getting naked and getting up on the roof, like it, really does make like a big difference, I think, to just the way that all the humor flows in this movie. Sydney, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, Sydney, what are your thoughts on this big ensemble cast?
I think you're on the right track. I also like how everyone at the same time, like it looked obvious that we all clicked okay on that extension of the Zoom meeting. Oh man, I had like a great kind of like one-liner quick review of this movie, but now that you guys are both up on this movie, I don't know. I don't know if I want to do it. Just kidding.
No, you have to.
I have to do it. I gotta get a voice going. Ready?
Oh Jesus Christ.
Whose voice?
The voice of this review.
Oh, okay.
You ready?
Mm-hmm. Born.
So ready.
Death at a funeral? More like death at a movie theater. Because this movie is dead on arrival. A zing! Yeah.
Oh, man.
Not up on this movie one bit. No, sir. No, thank you. And now I feel like I'm getting What About Bobbed again. Where most people are like, well, so far, two out of the three people who've given their opinion on this have been like, yeah, this is like a really good movie. I'm just like, what? I hated this movie. It was not good. I didn't like it very much at all.
Why?
Well,
because of the cast?
Yeah, like for one ensemble cast. And man, none of the jokes hit for me at all. Like, I felt like they were all pretty much misses. Like, the only exception to the cast that I actually enjoyed was Alan Tudyk.
But I was going to say.
It's hard to hate him.
Yeah, he's...
impossible, even.
But everyone else I just didn't care about or actively disliked. So, yeah, I don't know.
Hmm. Wow.
This is not...
Would you like it better if they'd all been Muppets?
You know, if it was, like, the exact same plot, yes. Who would Peter Dinklage's character be?
Gonzo?
No.
I don't know. Someone who's a little like off the beaten path, like
Gonzo, probably.
Yeah.
And then, Alan Tudyk's character.
Oh, I don't know.
I feel like you have to leave one or the other as that actor. You know how all the Muppet movies have like.
Oh yeah, just have human Alan actors. Tudyk tripping balls with all the different Muppets. Oh yeah, that's great. He takes the pills, and every one just turns into Muppets.
Okay. There you go.
Okay, I'm back into this movie.
Yeah. Kermit is Matthew McFadden. I mean, we...
right. Oh yeah. That's perfect. What a great movie. All right, you should pitch that to Frank Oz.
Hell yeah. And I'll give him a budget of $50.
Yeah.
He loves small budgets.
He did get really excited about this small budget. That's something.
Paige, am I an outlier or is the room split? Tell me, what is your opinion on this movie?
The room is not split. Oh, I definitely like this movie.
Oh, no. Oh, no. I'm the fool.
Yeah, you are. No, I'm just kidding. No, I liked this movie. I thought this was a fun movie. I think, like Ethan said, we've been kind of in the Frank Oz pit of partial despair for a little bit, and I think this is like the light at the end of the tunnel. I guess I was using a pit metaphor, so that doesn't really make sense, but it's kind of
describing it as a mine.
He was using
felt more positive than pit of despair, but anyways. I guess we know your opinion on Frank Oz.
It was a breath of fresh air, and I think that I agree that I wish there was more after this, because this feels more... this feels almost like he did like a loop, like he went back to Dark Crystal, Little Shop of Horror times, as far as the quality of the humor and the characters. So it's almost like I don't know what I'm trying to get at. I just feel like he did a weird career loop. That's what I'm getting at, I guess. But... yeah, I mean, Alan Tudyk is freaking hilarious. It doesn't get better than Alan Tudyk climbing around on a roof butt naked. What's better than that? Nothing. Nothing at all. So,
him desperately pulling off toilet paper from a toilet roll and being like, yes, jarring the others. That was pretty great.
Jarring the others. Walking past the Martha's father after he's like, you can't marry this man, and he just goes, daddy. Oh, classic.
I wonder how much of his stuff was improv, because like,
yeah,
because he is such a really like a talented guy and it really funny, and I would have loved to have been on set to see him just trying stuff as, you know, a guy who's tripping balls.
I know Frank Oz is very much someone who lets their actors do a lot of the improv. I mean, he usually gets like one shot, like straight down the middle, like let's do what the script says, but then he'll kind of let them play with it afterwards. I mean, a lot of that has to be his improvisation. Because, I mean, you're talking about a guy who's used to working with like Steve Martin, you know, and
who Ethan hates.
You're just going to take my words out of context?
Yep.
I believe my exact words were, I adore Steve Martin. I think he's one of the funniest men alive. I just don't like him in movies.
Check the tapes. Paige, pull up wherever that came from in the podcast and then play it here.
All right, I will do that.
I think it just released, or it did last week.
I knew it. You did say that you hated Steve Martin.
Right,
it was in the tapes right there that Paige definitely pulled up and played. Anyways. I'm sorry.
Anyways,
good movie, right, Sydney? Continue. Yeah.
Well, let's get into the movie.
No house sitter.
That way we can.
Oh, no.
I'll argue Sydney down.
Yeah.
So at this point, we would normally talk about the cast. However, being such a large ensemble movie, it's going to be really hard to go through the cast ahead of time. So I think we're going to try and just hit them in the plot as we go through their different specific beats. So, Paige, now's the time already for you to give us your 10-word summary, no more, no less, of the plot of Death at a Funeral.
All right. Death at a Funeral. Death brings eventful day of drugs, nudity, love, and murder? With a purposeful question mark.
I like how only the last thing didn't involve Alan Tudyk. Everything else was just his character.
Sometimes my plot summaries are not completely unbiased, but that's all right.
I think there's a lot to go around.
Hey, you know
there's
what? That was a good
of
one.
That happening.
Let's go, Paige.
Woo! Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Woo! Okay.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's jump into the plot of this movie and start talking about our first kind of trio of characters. So we've got Matthew McFadyen is playing Daniel, who is our main character, one of the sons of our deceased, you know, the deceased in the movie. And then his wife, I believe, is played by Keely Hawes. She plays Jane. And then Rupert Graves is Robert, his brother. And so these three's kind of general gist of what they're doing is Daniel and Robert are just trying to have a nice funeral for their father. But they're arguing over a lot of money things. Robert is a successful author, whereas Daniel is just an aspiring one. And Daniel and his wife Jane are trying to buy a flat together.
Is it just me or... is Rupert Graves. That's the brother you said.
Yep.
Is he just like a knockoff Tom Hiddleston? Do you get that vibe too?
Oh, no. What?
No? Oh. You know, every time I looked at him, I was like, this reminds me of Tom Hiddleston. No?
Was it just the long black hair?
Any person with long black hair, it's Tom Hiddleston. I don't know. I don't know. That's a great question. That's where my brain went. So I just want to make sure I wasn't alone, but I am.
Well, you know what? I'll throw one out there. Matthew McFadyen. Sometimes I thought he was just discount Owen Wilson. Discount. Anyone else? No, just me? Okay, moving on.
You guys just throwing out random people?
No. I did feel like sometimes there'd be a shot of his face in this movie, and I was just like, that kind of looks like Owen Wilson.
Wow.
We got so far away from that bit for so long.
Yeah, now it's back, baby.
Well, okay, so first of all, Matthew McFadyen is like 2 or 3 years off of playing the lead in Pride and Prejudice.
Darcy.
Yes, with Keira Knightley, right? So I think he's one of the more recognizable, like one of the things that Frank Oz was like slightly worried about when releasing this movie in the US was that basically none of these actors besides Alan Tudyk are familiar at all to American audiences, especially back in 2007. And I think Matthew McFadyen is like the only other one, probably. I looked up almost all of these people to try and find some, and of course Peter Dinklage. But I looked up all of these people to try and find like something that they had been in that I have seen, because I swear to God, this whole movie was like watching like vague memories of people's faces for me, because every time a new character showed up, I'd be like, Jesus, I swear I've seen them in something.
I absolutely agree with you. That happened to me so often.
And then I would, where are they from? Seen this movie before?
I doubt it. But and then each one I would look up, I would be like, no, there's no conceivable thing I've seen where I would have seen this person's face, and yet they are so familiar to me. But yeah, I don't know. And it's weird because this is like a lot of these people go on to have just weird long runs on TV shows after this movie. But yeah, I don't know. They were all so familiar, and I haven't seen like anything with any of these people in it. But yeah, anything you guys want to say about this little trio before we move on?
I thought they were great. I think throwing in the mom character kind of adds a whole lot to each one of them.
Well, and she's, so Jane Asher plays Sandra, who's the mom of Daniel and Robert. Huh. She was Paul McCartney's girlfriend at one point. Interesting.
Good for her.
Good for her for sure, I guess. But yeah, she's fantastic in this movie. Like, and she's dialed up to 11. I mean, most characters are dialed up to 11 in this movie, but she's really giving it her all, especially later in the movie when like her husband is rolled out of his coffin in front of her. The shrieks that she does are just incredible. But yeah, I like this fun little relationship that like these four kind of have with each other, because it's like Daniel and Robert have this competitive spirit, and of course one of the big things is that Daniel's going to give the eulogy, and everyone is always asking him, like, why isn't Robert giving the eulogy? And then, yeah, Jane and Susan just have this, or sorry, Jane and Sandra just have this relationship where they're always kind of picking at each other, you know, your typical mother-in-law relationship. And I don't know, there's so much fun to be had. Just like one of the really nice things I think about this movie is that every kind of pairing of character that you could have, it feels like have at least like one little scene together where they get to bounce off each other, and it all feels very lived in and very familiar. Like, these aren't people who are just meeting today. These are people who have had these like long histories with each other. Even the people, you know, who show up later who aren't related to anyone in the family, like they all still have these like intimate bonds with certain members, and I find that quite enjoyable. And Sydney hates it.
I hate it. Well, I thought it was also funny how Robert and Peter also have a scene together, and they're literally bouncing off of each other as Robert is trying to restrain him. So, boom, it's still accurate. Man, my take on that is, like, I didn't really care about these characters, and I actively disliked Robert because he just seemed like kind of a aloof douchebag. Yeah. And also the fact that he just escalates the movie, like the situation up to 11 with, like, you know, just kidnapping a man, that felt kind of weird. But I don't know, it's a comedy, it's supposed to be ridiculous, so maybe I'm just being stupid.
Ridiculous.
No. An aloof douchebag. It's me. No.
Yeah, I don't know. Because you're right, you don't really get a lot of, I don't know, there's not a lot of like character movement from anyone. They're all fairly set in their ways. I would say the biggest character movement comes in our next little trio we're going to talk about, but like for the most part it's just this one window into like this one afternoon in this family's life. But I really enjoy that because I don't have to think about like, does this work out in the future? Does anyone get better after this? Like, I think the little wrap up scene at the end is like a little superfluous. Like, I think it would have ended perfectly fine if, you know, when, and I'm jumping super ahead, but like when Daniel delivers the eulogy and everyone just kind of stops and takes it in, if the movie just like, boom, roll credits right there, and I don't have to worry about, you know, anything else, I think that it would still work super well for me. So,
yeah, I definitely agree with that. But Also, it almost seems like a Frank Oz signature to end the movie by, like, closing every single little loose end.
Are you telling me you didn't need to see the scene in The Stepford Wives where they make their husband shop for them?
Yeah, you know what? That one was a bit unnecessary. And, you know, literally all of his other movies, I think, end in some way, making sure, like, they tick off all the boxes. Like, yeah, this character's doing something. This guy's doing everything. Okay, we got them all. End credits. Or, not end credits, start the credits. But don't put any scenes in there. Or else I'm going to get mad.
And you're already mad enough.
I'm already mad. Yeah, there's more than too many characters. I'm fuming.
Well, next up, our next trio is, Daisy Donovan plays Martha, and she has her brother, Chris Marshall, is playing Troy, and they are the niece and nephew of the departed, and then Martha's fiancé is Simon, who is played by Alan Tudyk. And just a couple of the small dynamics here, so Simon, or Martha's dad, does not like Simon. Troy is a pharmaceutical student who also is mixing some psychedelic drugs on the side, and very early on in this movie, Martha gives Simon one of those drugs to help him calm down and instead sends him into an 8-hour acid trip. I think these are probably my favorite characters. Not Troy so much, but Martha and Simon. I mean, Alan Tudyk is the comedic force of this movie. Like, I think everyone's pretty funny in this movie, but it doesn't work if his character is not appropriately riled up. And Martha also, to me, supplies a lot of the emotional backbone of the movie as well, because even though it is absolutely wild to think that you would keep someone who's having an 8-hour LSD trip at a funeral, the way that she handles the whole situation and the way that she handles her father is so lovely to me. And I really just enjoyed that on, like, a human level, as well as the comedy of it all.
Like, I want to be friends with Daisy Donovan, honestly, after this.
Yeah. And, like, it's kind of, one could say it's kind of an easy comedic device to just, like, have somebody either drunk or on drugs just to, like, get some, like, free jokes. But it works so well here. And I think it has a lot to do with Daisy's performance as Martha, as, like, usually, you know, as, like, the straight man that's, like, you know, playing off of the ridiculous guy. But she has some, like, moments of comedy herself, and she's pretty funny, and I don't think it would have worked as well without her, for sure. Down to the part where she's, like, knocking on the bathroom door saying, Simon, and he goes, Simon, and she just keeps it going.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe my hottest take is, like, if Tudyk is the MVP, she's just one half step down for this movie. Like, I like the two of them better than pretty much anyone else in this movie.
I would have to agree with that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Oh, even Sydney's on board for Daisy Donovan?
I mean, well, I agreed with your statement that Alan Tudyk number one, she's probably number two.
Yeah. And then we have, so Andy Nyman plays Howard, who seems to be a family friend of Daniel and Robert, and then Justin is played by Ewan Bremner, also known as just the most visible, slimiest person alive. And these guys mm-hmm. seem to be just two friends who are coming to the funeral. And Justin has a past relationship with Martha that he pretty much spends the whole movie trying to capitalize on. And Howard is just a ship adrift on the ocean. He has to take care of Uncle Alfie, who's played by Peter Vaughn. He has to help his friend Daniel. He has to figure out what this rash on his hand means. He's really kind of the, like, connective glue that helps to hold a lot of these characters together, I feel like. Because anytime the movie feels like it doesn't know what to do next, they're like, I don't know, have Howard go up and talk to Sandra and like have that be a fun little scene. And then that'll help us transition to this next bit. Like, he seems to be just the guy who can bounce around anywhere and talk to anyone and help move the plot forward. And then, yeah, like I said, Justin looks like the slimiest man alive. And so it's very fun to watch him try and hit on Martha as she's having to control Simon's LSD trip.
He is sleazy. And everything he says is sleazy. So I do love, though, every time that, you know, she passes by and he just goes, I can't impersonate it well enough. Like, hey, Martha, like every single time. It's a good performance, and I do wonder if he looks like that always, but yeah.
Howard is really great in this too. Although I would say he's kind of a low light for me as far as like if you're the type of viewer that really can't stand like comedy that makes you anxious, he is that entirely, you know, like and that kind of can be grating if it's just, you know, every scene he's in, you're just like, oh my God, like this is so much anxiety in one person. I can't take it. But his bits with Uncle Alfie, I'd say the first part where like he's trying to park and then he has to push him up the hill, gets me every time.
The part when they actually get and they start to do the service and he's poking Martha in the back and he's like, we had Uncle Alfie with us.
We had Uncle Alfie in the car.
Funny. You took that parking spot. All right, here it comes.
I personally hate so much Howard's character. Oh. He's just such a pathetic, worthless person. He just gets like rolled over by everything. It's like, ugh. Sydney. God, I hate him so much. Not the actor. The actor's whatever. He's probably a great, great dude. Or not. I don't know. But Howard, no. Never Howard.
This Howard hate.
God, he just sucks so much.
Oh my God, you're so mad about it.
That's all I'm gonna say on that. I don't know. Like,
but they're like, I don't know. When it comes to like movies like this, especially like big ensembles, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're not getting full characters. Not a single one of them is like a full rounded character. They all serve a purpose for the comedy, so they're all gonna deliver different aspects of types of comedy to kind of combine it together. So like, yeah, Howard, if he were a real guy, he would suck. If any of these people were real people, they would probably suck and we would not want to hang out with them. But like the what they offer to the plot and to like the, you know, into the script is like combine it with the other characters and forget trying to make them a actual rounded character, because none of them are going to be in this style of, you know, comedy. And you just get to have fun with it.
Yeah. I think, yeah. You know what? That probably is a big reason why I didn't like this movie. Is like that exact reason that you said that, like,
you want the characters to be full characters, and they're just never going to be that in this type of movie.
Well, just that the part of the character that we see is mostly, like, unlikable or not likable as, like, their full, like, human person, personality, whatever, I don't know. But I think that's a big reason why I didn't like this movie, because I guess I extrapolated whatever, like, they did on screen to just, like, yeah, that's just what they do all the time.
Sydney's writing the fan fiction of, like, 5 years from now in his brain of each of these characters as he's watching the movie.
Well, it's mostly just all of them do the exact same thing in every single situation in real life.
One poll for Howard, too, and then I want to talk about the characters in general. But, like, Howard, to me, I also love that anytime he's on screen, like, he's going to be delivering the punchline. And so, like, in a scene where even if the camera's focused on somebody else and you see him in the background, like, I could just feel myself getting excited for, like, whatever he's going to say, because it's going to be funny. Like, when after the service goes wrong and the uncle is comforting Sandra, like in the kitchen, and you just watch Howard come in from behind, and I'm like, oh Jesus Christ, what's this guy gonna say? And he pops up and he's like, can you tell me about my wrist thing? Like as as he's trying to comfort, you know, this grieving widow. Yeah, I don't know. I like him as a force of, I use force of chaos too much, and he's not that chaotic, but like I like him as the wild card, I think, of this movie. But each of these characters, I mean, because there's some that I like. I mean, I like Martha. Jane is barely a character, unfortunately, but, you know, she's just trying to kind of keep everyone from losing their minds. And, like, Daniel is okay most of the time, besides when he kind of shoves Jane to the side. But, like, even the characters that I think are inherently unlikable as people, which would be, like, Robert, because he's kind of... What's the term we're using?
What did I say?
Tom Hiddleston.
Oh yeah, yeah. He's Tom Hiddleston.
No, I thought
he was Tom Hiddleston.
What's the douche one?
Oh, douche. Something that rhymes with douche.
It's gone now.
Oh, crap, what was it?
But he, so like Robert is super
I'll never
douchey.
Tell.
But like
a boosh,
even
not a boosh.
You're losing it.
A moose boosh.
A moose boosh douche. Is that not what it was?
No.
Oh.
It was something close, but anyways.
It was
so
a
like,
loof douchebag, in case you're wondering.
A loof douche, there we go.
A loof douche.
So, like, Robert, you know, even though he has all of that, towards the end of the movie, when he's, you know, actually helping with the whole Peter Dinklage situation.
The situation he caused?
Yeah, but, like, he is very supportive of Daniel at the end, and I think, you know, and he helps with his mom. And, like, Troy, despite being, like, a drug dealer who gets Simon into his whole situation, at the end, or throughout the whole movie, is still very supportive of his sister and, like, her relationship, and he wants to try and fix the situation. And then Howard, you know, is, like, a loyal friend, even though he's... a little weirdo. The only one that I don't think is redeemable is Justin, but I don't think he's supposed to be redeemable because he's human slime.
No, yeah. I like how Justin's character was executed.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't supposed to be likable. Like, I think some of the other characters were supposed to be. He was just supposed to, like, you know, try to woo Martha, right?
Yeah.
That was... And then, like, he has, like, that, like, after, like, it doesn't work, he's just like, oh, all women are stupid or whatever. He does, like, his, like, speech or whatever to Howard. So, yeah, like, Okay. I don't want to keep bringing down this podcast because everyone else likes this movie so much. So, I'll try to tone it down a little.
Well, we'll move ahead. I have a very pointed question for you next scene, so maybe we can talk about it there. But so all of these storylines, all these people come together at the service, and during the eulogy that Daniel is saying for his father, Simon starts to believe that there is a body coming to life in the coffin. And so he jumps up and tips the coffin over, much to everyone's surprise and horror. And it kind of kicks off the second half of the movie, which splits into kind of divergent paths here. But let me ask you this, Sydney. Do you think a lot of your dislike of this movie comes from how incredibly painfully awkward this scene is?
No.
No? You don't think so?
I don't think so.
Because I know, like, in the past, especially during the West days, I feel like you had a little bit more trouble with scenes that would be awkward or, like, characters that were creating, what would you call it, like, tense situations. Like a Scott's Tots kind of situation, I feel like, would put you off of
Scott's
a movie.
Scott's Tots.
It's an Office reference. I don't know if you've seen that. Okay.
Not but like that kind type of these comedy that like makes you feel anxious and makes
right.
you feel uncomfortable. Yeah, very Michael Scott, especially early seasons. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously when like that kind of like cringy humor comes up, of course I'm like, you know, convulsing in my like couch or whatever. I'm like, stop it, please. This is horrible. But I also am enjoying it. I didn't get that from this movie. Like
Okay.
The comedy just missed for me. And I guess in this scene...
It's not okay. I'm just kidding.
In that scene that you're talking about with, like, the whole sermon and everything, it just felt like chaotic, but, like, not in, like, a good way.
Okay.
I guess.
One last question, and I'll stop grilling you about it so we can continue to be positive in the positive three corners of this podcast. But do you like a lot of British comedies, or have you experienced a lot of British comedies?
I don't know. What's a good example of other than this movie, apparently? What's another good example of British comedy? Because none are coming to my mind right now.
Like Edgar Wright movies, like Shaun of the Dead.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
That's a big one.
Yeah, yeah.
Simon Pegg. I mean, him. They've worked together a few times.
Yeah, I think like the IT Crowd is a pretty huge like TV show, British comedy sort of thing. I don't watch a lot of like British comedy shows or movies really, but I'm really into like British stand-up and British comedians. So maybe like that's where my taste, like Taskmaster is an A+ TV show that everyone should watch, but it's just British comedians doing dumb things.
Stupid things.
And then, you know, making fun of themselves doing it. And that is like, I don't know, even though that's like a reality show and this is like a scripted movie, the humor translates, I think, very similarly.
Yeah. I don't think I have anything against British humor. I think I prefer kind of like deadpan, super sarcastic delivery of like lines, I think can be really funny. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think I just don't usually seek it out.
Sure.
And like I'm not just like, I don't type into Netflix British comedy and like click whatever I see. I guess if it's like British comedy style, I'm never like turned off by it, I don't think.
All right, positive crew, let's move on here. So after this interruption at the service, we have to deal with our main conflict for this movie. In a movie of conflicts, pretty much the main conflict comes from a gentleman known as Peter, played by Peter Dinklage, probably the third in that trio of fame when it comes to American audiences in this movie, who reveals to Daniel and Robert that he was having a homosexual relationship affair with their father. And that all he wants, which is pretty messed up, is he wants to extort them for money because he was left out of their father's will. And things go a bit sideways as our folks try to deal with Peter here. And first Robert kind of tackles him, ties him up, and then gives him some of the drugged Valium. And then later on, you know, with Troy and Howard helping out, Peter falls, hits his head on the coffee table, and allegedly dies. And so now they need to figure out what to do with this body. I think at times this movie gets a little bit criticized for the way that it makes its big joke being that the patriarch of this family was in like a homosexual relationship, but I think this movie handles it a lot more as if the characters are shocked, not because there was a homosexual relationship, but because it was their father specifically. And so I think it works really well for this movie. Paige, did you have a thought on that?
No, I think I agree with you. I don't think it was handled poorly. I don't know. I'm trying to like rack my brain and think about an angle where that would be true. Well, because they're never, like you said, it's not like they're like, oh, he was gay. It's, oh, he was married to this woman for however many years and was having an affair on the side. Like, that's how I read it. And that's what seems to be more of the point that they're trying to make with it. So, yeah, I don't really have an issue with it, but.
Yeah, none of it particularly came across as like homophobic. More so, it's like they were all just really shocked by the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would be as very shocked. Yes. Fair. So Peter Dinklage being a little person is like also not the joke. And I think Frank Oz was very specific about that. He was like, naturally, obviously, audiences are going to see that and make that the joke at first. But then as the movie keeps treating it as like not an issue, I think audiences will also see that that's not the joke at all. And I think it really does a good job of that, too. Like, and the role wasn't written to be played by a little person. It was just Peter Dinklage was the best for the role when he auditioned. And that's, you know, they rewrote a couple of lines, but that's all they had to do. And I think, you know, it comes across very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, we don't need to say it. So
right. <yeah. laughs> And then on the other side of things, the rest of our crew are trying to deal with Simon, who is losing his mind on acid and eventually strips naked, climbs up on the roof, and causes all of the other funeral goers to run outside and bear witness to him. And we as movie watchers get to bear witness to a lot of Alan Tudyk's bare ass.
Hey-o.
So much.
And eventually, that's kind of wrapped up by what I think is one of the most touching scenes in the movie, which is where Martha, played by Daisy, climbs up onto the roof and talks Simon down and basically tells him that they're pregnant and that he is going to be a father and that she loves him no matter what. And the whole funeral crew, everyone who's down on the ground, starts clapping for them. And I think it's a very touching moment.
It is.
Yeah.
It's okay.
I love that bit.
It's okay.
Well, and that her father too is so disapproving of it the whole time. And she just doesn't care. And I think that's maybe like the most wholesome part of it is immediately after Simon flips the coffin and runs outside, her father comes out and is like, you can't be seen with him. And he's like, and she's like, well, guess what? We're moving in together and we're getting married. So eat it. And then like later when he's on the roof naked, she's like, we're gonna have a kid. Like, yeah. And her dad's like, I guess I just have to like accept this now. And it's very touching.
I felt like her speech monologue to her dad about him dying alone and sad felt a bit aggressive to me.
Oh, no, I think that's very fair.
Okay. I liked it.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
But I've also, never mind.
Just cut that out. We don't need...
I've been in... Not me.
Positivity triangle. Push out the negativity.
I've known people who have been in the situation where they've had to cut family off over stuff like that. And so, I don't know. Like, on some level, if you don't take that power move, they'll never really truly figure out and understand. So,
I respect. If you don't do it early, too, yeah.
Yeah.
This is my stance.
You've never been in a moment where someone that you're in love with isn't loved by your parents? You've never felt that before? That's never happened to you? No? Oh. Did I just fever dream this?
Oh. Okay, I guess that's fair.
We had a good start.
Thankfully, we didn't have to, you know, completely shut my family out. But I would have for you, of course.
Yeah.
Aww. Thanks. I'm glad this is something y'all can laugh about.
Oh, yes. At this point.
Just the mention of that makes me want to sweat. I'm a newlywed, so.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well.
Good times. And then, yeah, we gather all of our characters. Oh, and of course, most importantly, while everyone is out watching Simon be naked on the roof, our crew of boys hides Peter in the coffin with their father, so that they can be buried together and no one has to know, which of course leads to the second service with everyone reconvened back together. This time the coffin actually is alive, bursts open, and all of our secrets come flooding out. Peter hits the ground. The pictures of him and their father falls out of his pocket. Sandra sees them. All pandemonium breaks loose, which is then stopped by Daniel, who just wants to give a good eulogy for his father and send his dad off right, which calms everyone in the audience. And then we get our little epilogue scene where it's revealed that everyone's doing okay, except Uncle Alfie, who got given all the rest of the LSD Valiums and ends up naked on the roof to wrap this movie off of on a very interesting note. Naked old man.
That scene felt weirdly CGI.
Yes, incredibly CGI.
Okay.
In a movie that hasn't needed any of it the entire time, it definitely stuck out like a sore thumb right at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I can understand not wanting to put like a 90-year-old man up on the roof.
Well, yeah.
Of a building. That's
fair. Cowards.
Cowards. Ruins the authenticity of this movie, says Sydney.
Right. Everything for the art. So let's risk all the elderly men.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Any last thoughts about the plot of this movie?
I'm not convinced.
Okay. Well, we tried.
Even with the positivity triforce, my evil heart says no.
I mean, I liked it. I don't know. I think a kind of chaotic ensemble screwball comedy, I guess. Its perfect setting is a funeral or a wedding or some kind of day of contained event where you see people either at their best or at their worst, usually at their worst because that lends to more comedy. and you just kind of like go from there. So yeah, I think I like these types of contained stories where you're just getting like a slice of whatever these characters are, either at their having the best day of their life, the worst day of their life, something has happened that, you know, they're acting like they're not themselves. And it lends to a lot of opportunity for small jokes and like large things that happen that, you know, it's a lot of unbelievable stuff, right? Like never in your life will you, you know, drug somebody and then shove them in a coffin. Like, hopefully.
I mean, listen, right? Ellen, you don't know my pastimes, so.
But like there's a level of like, it's so outrageous, but it can be grounded in like, this is one day of everyone's life that's like the worst day they ever had. Like, mm-hmm. You know, it just goes from there. Yeah. I love it.
And I like to kind of piggyback on that a little bit, but I like that the movie never has to explain everything to everyone. Everything just kind of resolves itself. Like for all the other funeral attendees, they never even know that Simon is on drugs. Like half of those old ladies go home and they're like, it's weird that well, lady still that wanted guy? To marry that naked guy, but you know, whatever. And
the funeral things happen.
And they never explain, you know, to everyone like who Peter is or anything like that. And I just like putting myself in the place of someone who doesn't know the rest of the plot of this movie and was just sitting at the second service is very fun to me as well.
Yeah, and it's rare occasions like that you get all these people that you're related to or that are like friends of relations together that you probably never see. You're not going to reach out to hang out with them in your regular life. So it's just fodder for like, you know, remember that one time so-and-so got naked on the roof, like, and it's a person it's a person that you'll have to see every so many years of your life, and they're like on the peripheral, and like, I mean, there are real life versions of like that second cousin of yours got drunk and got on the table at that family reunion. We'll see them again in 4 years, like,
like. Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about the reception. So this movie made $46.8 million on a budget of $9 million, which makes it proportionally Frank Oz's greatest financial success right here at the end of his career. Not actual dollar gross-wise, but it's pretty impressive, I think, that this movie made $46 million, especially because, like I said, there's like three potentially recognizable people for American audiences, and yet it still did really well here in the U.S. as well as in the U.K., so I think he should be really happy with that. It did get kind of mixed reviews from critics, ended up at about a 62% on Rotten Tomatoes, but for the most part, I think a lot of people think this movie is very fun.
For the most part.
Steers, you know, some would say three-fourths of people.
Yeah, I mean, this podcast gives it a 75%, so I mean, yeah, that's actually pretty close to the consensus.
Yeah. Not bad.
And then, interestingly enough, this movie got an American remake just 3 years later, directed by Neil LaBute, starring Chris Rock, Tracy Morgan, Martin Lawrence, Luke Wilson, Zoe Saldana, James Marsden, Keith David, Danny Glover, and Peter Dinklage comes back to reprise his role. As I mentioned before, I watched it, and I think it's an oddly by-the-book remake. Like, a lot of the scenes are actually very similar. But I will say, like, every time that the UK version knows to just like let a joke sit, I feel like the American version has to kind of like try and spice it up a little bit. So, for example, like the most obvious one to me to point out was when, after Daniel finds out that his father had this relationship with Peter, he like steps out of the study and there's these two old men standing outside and they're like, "Oh, I was just telling him, like, when we were little, your dad made us skinny dip all the time." And, like, Daniel just, like, looks down, takes, like, a deep breath, and then just, like, keeps moving. And in the American version, it's, you know, Chris Rock plays the Daniel part. He steps out of the study. The same thing happens. And then Chris Rock has some line, like, "That's just wrong," or something. And then, like, storms off. And I'm like, it tries to punch it up to be, like, American humor, where we kind of need things a little bit more spelled out. Not to say bad things about Americans.
American stupid. Ethan Cooper, 2021.
Yeah.
Americans and Steve Martin, stupid.
Stupid. Yeah. Jeez. Thanks. But yeah, I don't know. And then also, for being kind of, to me, the core of the movie is that like Martha Simon relationship, and that is Zoe Saldana and James Marsden in the remake. And James Marsden, not as charismatic or funny as Alan Tudyk. And then Zoe Saldana, like, weirdly playing it very soft, I felt like. And so, like, that relationship doesn't work as well either. And it adds a little bit more to a couple of scenes. Like, I don't know. It's weird because it is a lot of the same movie. But all the things it adds, I think, detract from the movie, actually. And critics would agree with me. So the film was received worse than the original, got about a 42% on Rotten Tomatoes, but it made roughly around the same amount of money, but they upped the budget quite a bit. 'Cause I mean, that was a large number of stars. The budget was about $21 million instead of the $9 million that Frank Oz made this movie with. Do you guys have any themes, lessons, or last thoughts before we get on out of here?
I'm glad Frank Oz isn't making any more movies. This is what he would make.
Wow.
Boo. Nah, I don't mean that. It was a joke, Frank Oz. Forgive me. Forgive me, Mr. Miss Piggy.
Maybe the Muppet remake. Now we're really on
the blacklist. What was that?
Maybe the Muppet remake will be the one for you.
Yeah.
I would love to see him get back to it. He has said that he would if Disney wants him to, basically. So maybe someday he'll get the chance. And like,
I think he might. They just released like the original Muppet Show on the Disney Plus. And so they can garner an audience.
For sure.
I'm here for it. I love the Muppets.
Yes, please.
And what was I going to say? Like, he did kind of soft retire from directing. I mean, he did, like, two TV show episodes, essentially, after this. But this is also the same time where he, like, completely retreated from doing anything with the Muppets. And he said, like, "I have four kids. Like, I just want to raise my kids and, like, watch them grow up." And I think now, speaking in the year 2021, like, his kids are grown, and he's starting to maybe wade his toes back in and see, you know, test the temperature. And like I said, we'll talk about it in a little bit.
Wait, I don't know.
Shut up. I said weird things. Let it go. But we'll talk about it in a little bit. But like, he directed the stage production in and of itself, like an off-Broadway.
I find that so interesting that of all the people that could have directed that, I don't know what the relationship was with Frank Oz. Mm-hmm. Especially because in and of itself, it's, you know, y'all need to watch it because it's just so great. But the bit of it, part of it is like it's kind of an illusionist act. So I forget his name, but he has to have so much control of how it looks to an audience.
Derek Delgadio.
Yeah. So okay. Like Derek must have, I mean, obviously had to be super collaborative because like he as the illusionist, even when it's translated to film, like he's got to have so much control of how the illusions, you know, appear. So I feel like he could have gotten anyone to direct that.
Right. But
it's interesting to me that Frank Oz did.
Yeah. And it's very interesting. I think that not only did he direct like the recorded version that's on Hulu, but he did direct like the actual stage production. Yeah, and he's never done any like stage productions or anything like that. Like this is his first one. I mean, the Little Shop movie is in some ways kind of a stage production, but not really. So yeah, I'm very interested to see that. I did want to give kind of an odd Frank Oz take here, and I'll talk about it more on the wrap up episode, but if there's one line thematically that I can chart through all of his movies, the relationship that Frank Oz characters have with their true identity, I think is very interesting. So like Dark Crystal doesn't really count. I mean, that was Jim Henson's vision. Frank Oz just kind of helped. But like Muppets Take Manhattan has it kind of right at the end where, you know, Kermit gets hit on the head. He forgets who he is, and then his friends and like their persistence to try and help him helps bring back who he really is and his true self. And then some of these are going to be leaps and stretches for the record, but I think that it'll pay off in the end. And then like Little Shop of Horrors, you know, Seymour for the majority of that movie is hiding who he really is, trying to be more famous, trying to be more successful, hiding this big secret. And in the Frank Oz version, like that hiding of who he truly is what ends up getting him killed and like dooming the world. And then like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, the whole movie is predicated. All three heroes, quote unquote, are hiding their true identities from each other. And again, like it only works out at the end when they reveal who they are to each other. It doesn't really track completely for What About Bob or for Indian in the Cupboard. I know, I told you, some, you know, not all of them, but like House Sitter. I was
waiting for you to connect this to Indian in the Cupboard.
Right?
I know. But like House Sitter, again, like Goldie Hawn is hiding her true self. Like her and Steve Martin are tied up in this big lie about who they really are. And again, it only works out for them when they reveal to each other the truth about themselves. You have In-N-Out. Kevin Kline is hiding like who he really is. The whole movie, he's hiding this homosexual side of him. The score, like Ed Norton has this whole other personality that he's performing like to help out with this heist. And he is such a dirtbag in that movie because I think like he doesn't realize how bad it is to hide who he really is. And then you've got Bowfinger, which isn't really like a identity thing, but they are trying to keep this like big secret that backfires in all of their faces when they don't. Like when they won't admit it. And then you have the Stepford Wives, which again, like Glenn Close is hiding this big secret. And again, it blows up in her face when she doesn't reveal who she is and she tries to hide her true identity. And then again, it like in Death at a Funeral, Frank Oz's last, theatrical movie, it's interesting to me that the person who is hiding their true self is the one in the coffin, right? The dead person in this movie is the person that is hiding. And Frank Oz talks a lot about, in a lot of his interviews, feeling a lot of like imposter syndrome within Hollywood and wanting to make a name for himself and not wanting to solely rely on the Muppet stuff. And I wonder how many of those threads are coincidental, but how many of that, how much of that is Frank Oz kind of putting this idea or this thread into like, who really am I? Am I worthy of all of this? Like, what does it mean if I allow myself to be myself? And so then that tracks all the way to, I believe my interpretation of what I know is in and of itself is like literally a stage production about who you are inside. And so it's interesting that that is the project that brings him back into this world of directing. And I'll try and have a more streamlined, put together version of that for the wrap party. But if there's one main, you know, if there's a Wes Anderson daddy issues theme through all of Frank Oz's movies, I think like what your true identity is it.
Very interesting.
I have nothing that deep or interesting to say about Frank Oz's filmography.
I think I gotta mull that over.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Maybe come back with thoughts for the wrap party.
Mm-hmm.
Well, special thank you to Michael Thompson for our logo. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast. If you have time to do that, that just really helps us out, helps move us up the charts, and helps us to find more listeners. If you want to share your thoughts and tell me that my theories are long-winded, you can email us at discoveringdirectorspodcast@gmail.com, or you can find us at DDirectorPod on Twitter or Discovering Directors Podcast on Facebook.
Or if you hate this movie, let us know. I'm not the only one.
Let us
I'm
know
not if, the only one.
If you're on Sydney's side or if you want to join the triangle of happiness, of positivity.
Yes.
And you can find Ellen at We Should Watch a Movie or Love That Movie or both. Ellen, is there anywhere else you want to be found?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Ellen Toudouze. That's ELLENTOUDOUZE. Yeah, I got married this year, but I have not changed my Twitter handle yet. yeah, and then on Instagram at Ellen Toodles.
Awesome. Well, join us later this week for our Frank Oz wrap party, where we will also talk a little bit about In and of Itself. And then join us next week for our next director. We're going to be talking about James Mangold, starting off with his weird movie that no one has ever seen that I had to order a used DVD on Amazon in order to see Heavy. So this is your warning. Again, if you want to watch Heavy, order it now on DVD from Amazon or your local library, potentially. And I just have to say, guys, I'm so excited to talk about James Mangold. Looking at his filmography this last week, I realized, I mean, Sydney picked him, but it very well could have been a very Ethan pick. I mean, you've got two Wolverine movies, you've got a Johnny Cash movie.
Ford versus Ferrari. Ethan loves cars.
Yeah, yeah. Ethan adores cars. That's the outlier. But you've got a bunch of movies that aren't family comedies, and then a Tom Cruise action movie. I mean, what more can I ask for? That sounds completely up my alley. So join us then for James Mangold. Thank you all for coming.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.